You're not going to believe it. We have another episode of the Backpack Show to cover today. Welcome. I'm Chris Brogan. Welcome to the Backpack Show. Today, you know, you know that we find business insights and success stories from unusual places. So why wouldn't I talk to someone whose build is the accidental puppeteer? That's an interesting phrase, by the way. I really love the concept because I like he slipped and fell. All right, this guy, I'll talk for him now. But Sam Lewis is here. He's got a lot to talk to us about. We're going to cover all kinds of ground. We're going to cover race. We're going to cover history. We're going to cover slavery. We're going to get to see some puppeteering happen. There's so much. It's a big show today. Sam Lewis is my guy. And I'll say hi to Chloe. I'll say hi to my loving mother and father. I think I'll give you guys a phone call afterwards, by the way. Hello from Vegas. I forgot to ask Sam where he's from. He seems awake enough to be from anywhere. We got a lot to do today, so stick around, Sam Lewis. Lots to do.
Hi, everyone. Tim Kitzer from NBA Jam and NFL Blitz, welcoming you to the Backpack Show. Your hosts, Chris Brogan, Kerry Gorgone, Boom Shakalaka.
Backpack Show.
Boom Shakalaka. You know, you get to listen to that every single day. You can't not be cheery. Hi, Leslie. Happy Friday. I'm glad to see you survived the first. I wanted to bump all my ads out of the way fast and furious like, and it's April. I don't even know if PubSite's my sponsor anymore in April. I don't think they are. StreamYard. I am sponsored still by StreamYard, the nice people who make the software to make this show. Sam Lewis has used it. Why haven't you? cbrogan.me/StreamYard. Get your own damn show. If you don't find me attractive enough, and really who does, you can listen to the audio podcast of this show anywhere that there's an audio podcast because we cut out the little audio file. We drop it onto castos.com. Easy peasy. See the peas? Easy peasy. Actually, it's because it's pea pods and that's a podcast. Get it? This is worse and it never gets better. All right. If you want a .online domain, go to cbrogan.me/online. Throw in the code Chris in all caps. And you can get whatever you want. You can get puppetman.online for 99 cents for the first year. No lie. By the way, I had noted something, and I'm going to show you right before I bring out Sam Lewis. I had noticed that my Kermit behind me was not paying attention to me. Look at him back there. Look at him and look at action figure Chris Brogan. What are they doing? Are they playing? And they're playing like a Nintendo Switch. They could care less what I've got. They don't even know who the guest is today. So I fixed them. Now look at Kermit. Action figure Chris Brogan's still not having it, but Kermit's a little more down with the clown. So we're going to have it done. I'm going to grab my new pal, Sam Lewis. We're going to talk about puppeteering and everything else. Mr. Lewis, sir, thanks for being part of the show today.
Thank you, Chris. Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here. Good morning. And I must say that Kermit better pay attention because when puppetry is on the subject line, you know, Kermit's going to perk up a bit.
I mean, so many people don't even know the difference between a puppet, a Muppet, and a marionette. And I have to ask you, seeing as you're an accidental slip and fell puppeteer, how did that happen? Like, you know, one day you were in this line and the line said you were going to go and, like, I don't know, do heavy construction work. And they're like, just kidding, you're puppeteers. How'd that work?
Yeah, so I've been happily married for almost 20 years. And I was over at my in-law's house one day and they had some things that they needed to be gotten in the attic. So we went into this really hot attic and I look over and I see a whole bunch of marionettes. And one in particular just jumped out at me. And that's the one that I started puppeteering with. And, you know, it's a Black Americana, which is a very nice way of saying kind of racist imagery. Marionette made in the late 40s in 1947 from this company called Talentoon. And it just started speaking to me. I'm a huge fan of Spike Lee and his films. And the one in particular, Bamboozled, really had an impact on me. And he deals with a lot of that imagery in that movie. And so I had seen that movie not too long before that. And so I was like, I need to do something with this. And, you know, having a theater background, I may have been one of the, you know, early adopters of theater people who switched over to puppetry because they realized that there's a lot less boundaries over there and there's really great audiences in the puppetry community. So don't sleep on that. And so it's been a happy relationship ever since.
Let's dig in there for a second because I definitely want to get back to the whole concept of what it was like to see that puppet and like the mix of things you might have felt. But let's talk about the sense that you figured out that if you know, if you're not going to get the roles you want to get necessarily on camera, if you're doing some voice acting work, which maybe came later, but who knows, you figured out that with puppeteering, you could create your own work. You could build it. You could do all of the pieces, including the setting up of scripts and all that. Is that how that went? Like, how did you get from I've got a marionette to I think I should make my own shows?
Yeah, you know, it was a perfect storm of, you know, growing up in the 70s and, you know, being enamored with like Looney Tunes and other animation, being a theater kid since fifth grade, went to performing arts schools, being an only child and running around the house, like playing all the roles in every imaginary game that I played. All of that kind of collided with puppetry. And I was like, now I have a vehicle that I can do all this stuff with. And it was just so exciting. And, you know, you can just do whatever you want. And you don't even have to necessarily use a puppet, you know, because that's how giving the community is, where you can just have your hand or you can not have a hand at all. You can take your pants down partially and turn around and bend over and your butt is the puppet. You know, like I've literally seen that in performance. So, you know, it's so wide open and so freeing. And it was just such a joy to do stuff with. So I started doing shows and people were receptive.
How do you put together a show? And like, you explained a lot about how you grew up already acting roles. You know what I mean? You kind of had that actor bug long before you had a place to put it. But there's a big difference between I'm just going to use words through this puppet to I'm going to come at these people with it. I have an intention. I need them to feel a certain thing. I'm going to have to block and say things, you know, like what was that like at first, putting it together more than just a speaking part, an oration? Or and did you have help with that?
You know, that's part of the accidental puppeteering. I've never had a lesson in puppetry. I've never, you know, studied under anyone. There's lots of people now who I consider to be inspirations, but I didn't have that when I first started. But I'm an audiophile on top of everything else. And so I had been a spoken word poet. I'd been in hip hop groups and done a lot of stuff like that. And so it was a way that I could just layer all of those things on top of each other. It's like, bring the acting part, you know. And it's like, I, you know, back in the day, we would always say, you know, joning or capping on people, where, you know, you get into talking about someone and, you know, your mama jokes and all that stuff. And so there's that comedic flair that I have as well. And so just throwing all of that stuff into like a big gumbo pot, and out came these shows where I can dance and I can rap. I mean, this puppet was rapping. The puppet has been in a rap battle with an actual rapper and won the battle. So,
and you won.
That's how, you know, how freeing the whole thing is. And so I just think in terms of those presentations, and I love creating scenarios and creating environments. And, you know, one important element, especially dealing with this Black Americana marionette, was I'm also very in tune to advertising and negative advertising as it relates to people of color and especially Black people. And so I see commercials all the time, even to this day. I mean, I don't think that they go, and they still do a little bit, like people doing bug eyes and stuff like that. You still see that from time to time in commercials, and people don't realize the kind of racist origins of that. But there's a lot of still more subtle kind of negative imagery of Black people. And so I wanted to show that there was a toy that was created and it was marketed to the nation, to the world. And it had this negative imagery that then people went home and they kind of internalized. And then those people grew up and they denied you a job, you know, or denied right. you a loan, you know, because they felt like you were somehow less than. So I wanted to kind of confront that. And, you know, having a platform to do that where I can, you know, inject humor into
right.
that and make people like kind of laugh, just like as a lot of stand-ups do, where you're laughing, but you're laughing and you're realizing, man, that's the truth, you know? And it's a more palatable way to digest that hard pill, you know?
Yeah, well, the incredible last whole year of watershed content coming out of Dave Chappelle, for instance, like when he starts his 8-4-6 presentation and he says, you got to understand, I'm not here to make you laugh today. I'm not here to make you laugh. There's going to be parts you giggle. You should giggle. Don't feel weird. He says, but we're here to talk about 8 minutes and 46 seconds. This is a challenge. This is a big night for me. And I thought, wow, you know, that was pretty brave because, you know, he made his bones being a comic, but he wanted to talk something serious. And he also said he didn't talk for months and months after that happened. And people were kind of pooping on him for that. And he said, look, maybe there's a lot of other voices that deserve to be heard. And if I came out and I weighed my thoughts, then what's everybody going to say? Well, Chappelle said, he said, so I wanted other people to have that stage for a little bit, which I thought was also cool. Can we go to your marionettes? Can we look at them? Can you show us even your evil yes. marionette? And you know, and so, do you call it evil in your head?
No, like, no, not at all. I mean, I feel like just like...
I'm going to make you big here.
So...
Look at that. And they sold that.
They sold that. Yes.
Wow. Everything.
So they sold that as they called him Jambo the Jiver.
Jambo the Jiver, of course.
Yes. But, you know, in all fairness, Talentoon was an equal opportunity kind of defamer. Because they had a series of puppets, and this was one of them called Jambo the Jiver. He was supposed to be a zoot suiter, even though I don't think that looks kind of like a zoot suit. But, you know, that kind of clownish suit, I don't think it has the cut, but that's what they were going for. He was a New York zoot suiter. And, but they also had a Mac Awful, the Scott, and okay. I have him as well. He's not in such good shape. I have all of them, but, and then they have... a cop, you know, who has the red nose, the Irish cop.
Yes, of course.
You know, the drunk Irish cop, you know, and they have an African woman in a kind of grass skirt. And then they have a clown, you know, and so they have to make the standard clown, you know. And so they kind of poked fun at all non-WASPy individuals, but I just wanted to kind of reimagine him. So I renamed him, first of all, was the first step. And I called him Just J-U-S Hambone, you
just
know,
Hambone.
Just Hambone. And that's it. Just Hambone. Like a
what name. Stuff. Like? what's his, you know, I heard this thing once in Pixar that I've never let go of, or it might've been just Disney Animation. And they said with Big Hero 6, for instance, they do this one scene that you'll never see in the movie of like you go to a diner and everybody has to come in, sit down, order something, because you learn from your actor, you learn from your character how they walk into a diner, how they sit down, how they order. So I guess if Just Hambone were coming into a space to manifest that space a little bit, like what goes into it? Where does Sam Lewis's creative brain, you know, bring life and voice to Just Hambone?
Yeah, so he started as primarily voice, you know, and I started doing a voice like this. And, you know, they say, why do you call me Just Hambone? And I say, my mom asked me what I wanted for dinner. And I said, Just Hambone. And it kind of stuck. It's too early.
Yeah, that's a rough one to do early.
Coffee.
Yeah.
I need coffee.
No warm up. Debbie has a question.
That was how he started as a voice. But then he has the most amazing articulation,
okay,
and of any puppet. It's a well-made puppet, and he can dance his butt off. And that was the whole point. Even within the whole series of puppets, he's by far the best dancer in the bunch. And like, has made some moves where I was like, how did I do that? And that's why I really feel like, you know, not to be creepy or anything, but, you know, it's like these objects have a personality and they start to have a life. And it's like, you know, you're like, am I doing this? Am I just channeling this? Like, where is this coming from? And so then I got into him moving and I really stopped the talking so much, because there were really two iterations of him. I was doing him, and I like to counted by the presidential administrations. I was doing him during the Obama administration, and people, they liked it, you know, things were great. But as soon as 2016 rolled around and administrations changed and the tenor of the country changed drastically, then it had a really more urgent need. And I had stopped performing with him for several years because I felt like, you know, it ran its course. I really have nothing else to say with it. But then right. when 2016 came, I literally performed with him for the first time in like 4 or 5 years in November of 2016. And wow. right at that moment, it was like a bomb went off. And all of a sudden, I'm performing. And I had like all of these different bits. And it was like everything was so relevant. And people were like, yes, yes, we, you know, it was like, it was very different than the what I call the first iteration of it. And I thought that it was, and I feel like that is now kind of ebbing a bit as I transition into this, working with this new puppet, but he'll always be my dude, you know? And I really think he's in my opinion, he's a positive person because there are stereotypes and a lot of stereotypes are kind of based on some truths, but sure. they're limited truths, you know, they're not all encompassing truths. And so I play on that because, you know, I have uncles and cousins, and sometimes they act like just hand-bone acts, you know, but they're not negative people. They're positive right. people. I love them. And I think it's funny, some of the things that they do. And I don't mind people laughing with them. It's just right. when you're laughing at someone, I think is a subtle but great difference.
I could see that for sure. Sam, I promise you, I'm going to let you let go of puppets in a second, but can you show us just a little movement with them? Can you show us what sure. it is to imbibe movement?
Yeah.
And then while you're setting that up, Debbie had a question. She said, if they're not really in great shape, like you said, the Scottish guy's not in such great shape, do you repair them or how do people repair them? Or?
Oh, yeah, that's a great story. There's a guy, Michael Montenegro, mm-hmm. who lives nearby. I live in the northern suburbs of Chicago, and he lives nearby. And he fixes puppets. And I met him because he was talking about it. He's a puppeteer also. But I met him as he was talking about another project he was working on. And then I have multiples of these puppets, by the way. And so
okay.
I came to the realization during the pandemic, I was like, they're all broken in one way or another, because I'm very hard on them and I'm like, you know, like working these things. And over the course of time, they started breaking and I don't have, even though I come from welders and blacksmiths, I didn't have any tools and know-how to be able to fix them. And so he recently repaired all three of them. And so I'm back at full capacity. And so I'm really nice. Excited about that. So shout out to Michael Montenegro.
Good job, Michael. All right, let's get some puppeting.
Let's see.
He sure has cadence. Awesome and oh well and nice moves and incredible. These are useful as bridges to telling people about which of the stereotypes were, you know, possibly harmless and which of the ones were really damning. There's yes. there's a lot of hidden language in there that you were able to help people understand. When did you start mixing and matching that into it all?
Well, you know, it was really tough because it's really hard because he's so much fun and I wanted that to be a part of it, but I also wanted to make some powerful statements with it as well. And I think I've had varying degrees of success doing that. Mm-hmm. Kids love it, by the way. I see Dean.
Yeah. Dean's asking, kids, are they too gone to care? But
kids are I performed one time and wasn't a full kid. I've done full kids performances, but I've also done just adult performances or where adults were, and there's a couple kids were there, and there's one, I have it on video. It's kids just laughing hysterically the entire time. But yeah, so I felt like it was really hard because I want to say, like, look at this thing and be confronted with this thing and understand how this imagery can be hurtful, but also understand, thanks, Hillary, also understand how your mom, Diane, likes it. Hey, also understand how it can also be fun at the same time. And that's a delicate balance. And so
one
performance in particular I did during the height of the last presidency, as we were approaching the reelection, and Hambone comes on and he says, you know, he would really do anything. He would go and perform for the inauguration. He was assuming that this person was going to get inaugurated. It was going to win the next election and go for a second term. And he said he would be happy to come to the inauguration party and perform because no one has done more for his career than that man has done. And so he just wanted to say thank you. And he said, and everyone's like looking like, you know, this is a crowd of very well-meaning, very caring liberal folks. And
so
then I go, you know, and this is the song that I would do. And so I had my one of my best friends, who's like a brother to me, Steve Gady. He's a guitarist and drummer, but I had him, black man with a white flying V guitar.
Nice
cowboy hat on, and he starts playing this down 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 down. And so then I said, you know, blacks knew the place in the good old days. Whites were the race in the good old days. The good old days. The good old days. And so then I go into women. You know, new to high, you know, all this other, these other stereotypes. And I start going in the good old days. And so I asked that they started clapping.
Oh my gosh.
You know, and so, cause they started clapping when just the music was on. But then when I started singing the words, they were still shocked, but they were still clapping. And I was like, do they know what they're clapping to? And so I get through the song and it ends with, good old days, but they're never coming back. And then he switches to this juju
metal,
juju, and it like goes into like a punk rock speed. Ju-ju-ju-ju. Never coming back. You know, and I was just like imagining if I could really perform for like a room full of Republicans and do this good old days thinking they're all doing, then I do this never coming back part. And I was like, it killed, bottom line. And I only performed that twice, but I felt like that was like the moment when I kind of, when everything kind of came together with what I was trying to say with the puppet, you know.
Mr. Collins loves your voice as well.
Thanks, Robert. And
Carl says, but they're never coming back. Love it. I immediately, when you started going to the punk and the heavy music and all that, I immediately thought, I wonder if I can get this clip over to Chuck D. I bet he would love this. Oh. I bet he would love this.
I love me some Chuck D, of course. And you know, by the way, and I love punk music as well. You know,
that's like right.
Fear, Dead Kennedys.
Nice.
You know, Black Flag, all that stuff I grew up with, though. So, you know.
Yeah. Well, they, Chuck did that bit with the Prophets of Rage with Tom Morello and all the, you know, yes. Rage Against the Machine and the, you know, Cypress Hill and all that. So they had that super band going for a while until PE decided they're going to go back out on the road again for a minute. And that Rage is coming back so that Tom Morello has to kind of go be Rage Against the Machines again.
Yes. And please do, you know.
You're right. Good timing. So everyone's still in the middle of loving you for puppetry, and I got to pull the rug out and, you know, kind of have them look at all the other stuff you got going on. You've been doing so much, you know, I can't help it. My dad's like saying, you know, you're the man, you're brave and honest. Oh, thanks. And even the cat part of this. I wanted to talk a little bit about what you're doing with Auspice now. I want to talk about the Real Freedom Project. I mean, you have so many things to talk about. I watched the other interview with you where you talked about, you know, finding information about your great grandfather and his experience being a slave and all the documentation that came with, you know, you doing that research. I don't even know where I want to start. You pick one. You tell me what you want to talk about. I'm in.
Yeah. Well, just, I think it's a little faster. So, you know, I reached a point when I turned 40. I'm currently 51. So black don't crack.
No, it doesn't. I'm 51 yeah. next week. I don't look like, geez, Louise, Sam. Hang on a minute. I got to get you off my screen. Okay. What were you saying? 51. Good for you, Sam.
So when I turned 40, so long ago, I had a realization that I was as close to 20 as I was to 60. And I was like, that scared the hell out of me. And I was like, I got to get moving, because you think when you're growing up, especially if you're in the arts, you're like, I have time to do this and I can do that and I can accomplish this. And then you realize that time is moving. And if you don't start working and start doing stuff, you're going to run out of time, quite frankly. And so I started trying to get into overdrive, and I'm still kind of in that overdrive period now. And especially as I'm into this, what I call the touch of gray phase, where I'm old enough to know what I'm doing and young enough to still get it done, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I have to like really take advantage of that moment. And so because of that, and because of the times that we're in, I kind of have a lot of side projects on top of things that are really important to me as well. And side, not meaning that they're less important, but additional projects, you know? And one of them is the Real Freedom Projects, which is a monthly, it's a POC BIPOC focused streaming platform. We stream on Twitch. We stream once a month on the full moon. And we just had one recently, the Worm Moon stream. And that's the Real Freedom Projects with an S.
My bad.
Okay. No problem. Thank you. Just so they could find it.
On Twitch.
Yes, the Real Freedom Projects. Yes, Real Freedom Projects. And it's on Twitch. And that's been fun, because we kind of put out an open call for people to submit content. And if you see, and it's kind of like what I was saying with working with Hambone, is that Black people and just people in general, we're not a monolith, you know, and there's these stereotypes to try to put us in these small boxes. That's it. You got it. They try to put us in these small boxes, but we really are diverse, and we have like, who would, you know, people might not think that a 51-year-old Black man would be into Black Flag or Dead Kennedy, right. But I love that stuff, you know?
Right.
And so...
Whoa. Yeah. I waited too long. Now we're going to get the song. Woo. Okay.
Oh, that was great. That was fun.
I was in for it, but like, I'm going to get copyright struck.
So Real Freedom Projects, check that out. The next
Black Flag, you were saying that, you know, the fact that it's not a monolith, that's important. That's vital. So we're evidently very much of the same age. So when I went to high school, there weren't a whole lot of people of color in my high school, but there was this one kid, Tony, and Tony loved heavy metal and I loved hip hop. So Tony would have me come with him to heavy metal shows and he would come with me to hip hop. You know, kind of check each other. So yeah. Like we did Public Enemy and Anthrax together. We went to Slayer together, and you know, and guess what? Nothing ever went wrong at a hip hop show. The only time we ever had any trouble is all the metal shows, which was really let down. But you know, not all the metal, just you know.
Those are just kids though, just having fun, you know.
That's right. Playing.
But at a hip hop show, it's like these evil kids, stop the music, you know. But you know, I love hip hop. I felt like hip hop changed my life. You know, when I got a Chuck Chill Out mixtape from this guy from New York in 1986, you know, I've never really looked back, but I was fortunate enough to be into music long enough before that, where I developed like a love for jazz and blues and reggae and new wave and punk and classical and all these other, you know, just roots music in general. Yay. Thanks, good Robert. Friday. And so, yeah, it's like, I love all of that stuff. And it's like, I think that's one of the reasons why I feel like I'm into acting and into puppetry and into music and into these other things, is that I just like a lot of different stuff. I really want to soak in all of the good flavor that the arts and just people have to offer. And so, and then take part in that, but also support that and lift that up as well. And that's what we're trying to do with Real Freedom Projects. And so check that out. But then I also started a label called Auspice Now, A-U-S-P-I-C-E, capital, all caps, N-O-W, yes. And it's three other partners with me. We're an LLC, and we're going to be releasing some albums starting this year. And just like my personal taste, and it's a label that's tasked with lifting up Black voices and Brown voices as well, but and showing the multiplicity of those voices. Oh, that virtual concert, see Pollinate Bloom.
Was that a goodie?
Oh God, yes. She's amazing. So yeah, we're gonna be releasing some stuff on that label, but we also one of our partners, Jonathan Woods, is a great videographer. And so we make videos for people. We curate performances and shows. That's Radiant Devices. My girl Moj Day and Theodore with an F on the
Theodore.
He's in Berlin right now, and Moj Day is in Chicago, but they're an amazing duo. We're supporting all kinds of folks, you know.
You have so much going on at the same time. If I made you pull one thread all the way through all of it, Sam Lewis, and you can only, like, you know, this is it. This is what goes on your tombstone, and you don't get a multi-volume tombstone. What is it? What's your, what do you need the world to know about you?
That's a tough one. You know, it's like a mosaic, I think. And that's how I like to think of my life, is that, you know, I feel like it's really hard because some people know me as a sound guy who does sound for shows, or that curates shows, or is the director of communications at Ragdale, or is a puppeteer. But I always have this vision of this, like, and maybe it's a little antiquated now, but this like kind of black tie reception where everyone's like celebrating my life. And then they just like open up this floodgate, and all of these various people get together, and they're like, I know him from this, I know him from that. And then the people are able to more accurately put together the full picture of what I was about. And I feel like, right, you can't really say that until I've finished doing all of that, you know?
Right.
And so that's what I hope, is that, you know, I loved and I tried things, you know?
We've got Donald Glover out there. You know, I mean, he keeps showing the way that there's a lot of switches we can flip. And even though he's currently exploiting his bad side, our friend Lil Nas X is also saying, I've got all of it. I got multi things. I'm ready to act. I'm ready to do it all. So
yes, there's been a lot of debate about that Lil Nas X stuff, you know, and I've been looking at that debate, but I feel like at the end, you know, I always think, oh, people get caught up in these things. And, you know, if you were offended by it, if you support it, you know, so be it. But I feel like at the end of the day, don't forget, it's about marketing too. And, you know,
no question
about him, for better or for worse, you're talking about him, you know.
He's pushing a lot of plastic from all that, you know, controversy. So yes. The only thing I was a little twitched about was, and I guess they've already squashed it, was FKA Twigs, was the people that made her video said, you pretty much full on stole that whole pole dance scene, like kind of cut for cut. And when you watch that, you know, I've seen the video. I was like, oh,
yes.
And Nas said, yep, I see what you're seeing. You know, and he said, I'm really sorry about that. And then he goes, I'm going to donate, and whatever he said he was going to do. And Twigs was like, yeah, that's cool. I'm into it. Like, it was very handled, like really fast. Like, I'm sure the news didn't want that to happen because they were still mad that he has Satan sneakers or whatever they're mad at him for now.
Yes, absolutely. So, you know,
but it's a Sam Lewis show. So we're not on with him, but I was just, I was thinking about him because you and, you know, like I said about, you know, Danny Glover's just an actor. Donald Glover. Exactly. You've got so much more to do. When you start to want to say, okay, the worst happens. Another Black person gets killed for no good reason. It's a terrible story. We now are all saying that person's name with the collection of names that we're all having to remember. And I'm not making a joke of that at all. That happens. Sam Lewis, the creator, goes, what? What do you have to do now?
You know, it's like, you know, that debate has gone back and forth. It's like me and a lot of other people of color feel like we should not have to be your teacher in this whole process. You know, we learned the reality of the situation, sometimes firsthand, sometimes through close relatives, sometimes through the news, just like other people, you know?
Right. Right.
And so we put it together. You know, we can make sense of this and understand the huge wrong that it is. But people need to try harder to get to that realization, because I feel like the claim of ignorance, or I was raised around this, or I was like, were you raised without a television? Were you raised without a newspaper? Were you raised without a library? You know, like, these stories have been told again and again and again. It's not new. Even if you just want to start with, you know, the 2000s, or with, you know, the last presidency, if you want to start there, there's a whole lot there. But this thing goes back hundreds of years, and there's no mystery. And if you weren't taught it in school, there were books, you went to the library. And so I feel like people need to take some personal responsibility and try to get to that enlightenment point themselves, and then realize that, and that what they can do in the capacity that they have in order to make a positive change. And if that's just smiling at a person who's different from you as you walk down the street, do that.
Start there.
And do whatever is in your capacity to do. And so I feel like my art kind of touches on that in ways, but I always have this thing about not being so overt, or like just like laying it out. It's like I work in subtlety a lot. And so sometimes just coming on stage with the puppet is a statement. I don't have to say anything.
Right.
And right. People are going to start thinking something. And so then if I start saying some things and it's more encoded, I love codes, you know, I love speaking in that and having people have to think about it, or maybe they get it like a week later, like, oh, you know, I'm a Libra. So that balance of, you know, playing both sides and really kind of understanding both sides, I play a lot with that in my work. So
I said, you know, this thing happens, and you said, hey, well, my art's not really a fire truck. You know, so that's a good answer, right? That's a good answer, because you're saying my art's not here to be your interpreter. Like, thank you, but no. So then when do you say, I need my puppet? When do you say, I need to write a song? When do you say, I got to go find some actors because I want to expand? I saw this thing once. It was in his last documentary that Michael Jackson did, where he talked about, my job as a performer and your job as my dancers is I want to stretch my fingers out, and I want you to stretch me out like another 6 feet, because you have your whole body. I want you to be my fingers at the end of my hand. And I got what he was saying, and I thought, this guy is playing chess on another board. We're not on that chess board. What's the Sam Lewis of that? What's the, I need to go express myself right now.
Yeah. So it's kind of like, you know, that's people like Michael Jackson. I mean, they have this vision, and then they need a larger platform to express that vision. I always come from a more collaborative standpoint,
where
I'm like G-Force, you know, where it's like you get six of us together and then we can make this giant, you know, and we can storm through, and we're all a part of that. It's not one person's vision, you know?
Oh, that makes me cheery. G-Force. There's only three people on this call that got that, I think. Valerie says everyone can do a power audit. Ask yourself, you know, where you have power and how you can use it to help someone else. In the time we have left, I want to talk just a little bit about slave research. You went and did some family research that turned into being also slave research. And I found that fascinating, but I wanted to know what you took from it, and, you know, what you wish even more people could understand through what you just did.
Yeah, absolutely. And so first of all, just in a matter of just defining and talking about language, I don't try to refer to my ancestors as slaves. I feel I like to use the term they were enslaved, because it was something that was put on them.
That's helpful.
And I never like to use that master or slave master terminology. I like the enslavers. And because quite frankly, that's the truth of it. But, you know, and the horrible thing and the great thing, maybe, who, depending on your perspective, is I have people on both sides. You know,
that's wild.
I did my DNA. I am 30% European. Me, you know, and most African-Americans in this country are at least 20 some odd percent European. And so that when you start looking at it in that context, and of course, that is largely due to, you know, a culture of rape and sexual assault. But however we got there, we can talk about that all day, but however we got there, we are there. And so the story of what we call Black people in the United States is really a story of a multicultural people at its core. And, you know, I think we too often are let people put the slave moniker on us when we have ancestors that were the enslavers as well. And so, I would say to people as it relates, because I feel like my story is incredibly interesting, but I can understand how people would be like, well, I have a history too. And, you know, what's your story? It doesn't relate to me, you know, or maybe it relates to me partially or something like that. And so I think to take it a step higher, I'd say I'm trying to encourage people through my story to ask their own questions, because that's how I found out about all this information. And so my mom, unfortunately, separated from my dad when I was like 3 years old, and I was whisked away to St. Louis, and I grew up in St. Louis. I was born in Mason, Tennessee, which is about 45 miles outside of Memphis. And, you know, I was born into a house that included my grandfather, who was a blacksmith, who purchased this land that we were on in 1917 and opened a blacksmith shop and was a very successful blacksmith, one of the most successful blacksmiths in the area. And then my dad kind of took on the trade, and then they transitioned into welding and all of that good stuff. And so there's like this huge history there. But when I was whisked away at three, I was pretty much the rest of my existence up until recently was mostly concerned with my mother's side of my family. And so I love those people. They're very accomplished, great people. But I always felt this like nagging that I was different. And I've always felt like I was a kind of an in the margins, you know, type of person where like my musical tastes didn't always fit within these narratives. I didn't always like stuff that Black people were supposed to like, you know. I just always felt like I'm different. And so, and I felt like something, you know, is missing. And so I started asking questions at the end of 2018 and saying like, who would have information? Who would have information about this? And through this whole process of, you know, going from person to person, I finally came in touch with a woman who is actually in the area. And I had been over her house, a cousin of mine. And she said, you know, who is your grandfather on your father's side? And she's like starting, she's like, oh yeah, and your great grandfather is this person. It was like she was reading something. And I was like, how do you know all this stuff just off the top of your head? She says, I'm reading a book, a self-published book by a man named John Marshall. And she said, you need to meet him. And I said, okay. And so he is a little bit older than me. I think he's in his late 50s now. And he's a judge in Memphis, in the Memphis area. And his family was the main families that enslaved both sides of my dad's side all the way back to before there was a United States, when it was still just the colonies. Wow. And so I've been able to trace that story all the way back to the mid-1700s. And he knows so much about my family and so much about just a lot of life in this area and the history of it and how we came from Virginia and North Carolina. I was able to trace my lineage back to what I call slavery 1.0, like the pre-cotton gin slavery. Mm-hmm. And I was able to do that. And then, you know, like you mentioned, I saw bills of sale for my relatives where they were sold for $650. I've seen photos that I never knew existed, heard stories that I never knew existed, and it was all there. And I thought, there's no way anything is there. But just, I would say to people, start asking questions and don't underestimate how much of your history has been documented somewhere and is waiting for you to discover it. And so I've been unpacking all of that ever since then. And it's been really, I feel like I hit the genealogical lottery, because it's like I watch, Finding Your Roots on PBS, you know, and I see people getting blown away by learning much, much less than what I know. And so it's like, it's brought me to tears. It's made me happy. It's made me like feel weird, you know, and I'm getting this from this man who has a complicated history. His family, his loved ones are the ones who did this, you know?
So that's what I want to, I felt like we kind of swished over that part and I was coming back with my highlighter to say, Sam, this guy is the direct descendant of the people who did all the enslaving. This is the guy on the wrong side of history, so to speak. Now, number one, he's super cordial. Number two, he's got all this wealth of knowledge. He can't wait to share with you. Yes. Even though it's not his best day in any of that documentation, his family.
And, you know, and I feel like it's part atonement and it's part that he's really just addicted to the information. And that's one of the things that, you know, I've used to, quite frankly, to my advantage, because, you know, he has a lot of people now, because there's a lot of people in the community that know that he knows this information. Some people are interested in leveraging it. Some people aren't. But he speaks at Black people's family reunions. He goes to Black churches and speaks, you know. And so he's very open about sharing the information. But, you know, I've never challenged him, but I have like talked to him. I'm like, you know, trying to get to the bottom of why I'm 30% European. Like, where did that come from? Do you know what the likely sources of it are? Because I started seeing a lot of grandparents, great-grandparents, great-great-grandparents, they were all biracial. And I was like, and the reason why he knew these stories, because his relatives, I mean, they owned like upwards of, some of them, 2,000 enslaved people, you know? Wow. And so how did you know my story out of all of those other stories? Is because, you know, for better or for worse, my people were some of their favorite slaves, you know, in their minds, you know? In fact, they didn't even call them slaves. They called them servants because they were in the house a lot. And so that's why their story is known. And so I grew up as a Black Episcopalian. I grew up as an Episcopalian and I went to a predominantly Black church. And I always wondered, like, how did I become? And my mom always said, well, you know, I became an Episcopalian because your dad's family was Episcopalians, you know? And I was like, well, in rural South, there are Episcopalians when everyone else is Baptist, Methodist, you know? How is that? And so I found out because my ancestors were baptized in the Episcopal Church during slavery.
My gosh. And
I went to the church, Chris. My family helped build the church. It still stands. And I went to a service there in 2019. And it was one of the singular most powerful things I ever witnessed, of being in this one room church that sits in the middle of fields that were where enslaved people worked. And, you know, there's no piano, there's outhouses, there's, you know, there's nothing, you know, you open these windows and you just, bugs fly in and they drift through, breezes come in. And I was really transported back to the 1800s of how it was. We sitting on the same pews, you know, like it was amazing. And so, you know, this story is still unfolding. I'm still learning. Like a couple of weeks ago, I learned another bit of information. I saw a photo of my great aunt that I never knew existed, who moved to California in the 1910s, you know. Like, there's just so much that is, and I'm still trying to process that. And part of the way I'm trying to process it is through puppetry, but it also may be a book. I feel like there's a book there, because it's not just about telling that story, but it's about how I looked at and dealt with learning that information. And so it's really a contemporary story as much as it is about history.
Right.
And so I really feel like it's powerful, and I would truly encourage people to start asking questions. You don't know who knows bits of information that can really add color to the past, and not just the distant past, but the recent past, or things that, you know, you may find interesting. And then also in terms of reparations, which I'm a huge proponent of, and I feel like that there should be a changing of monies, but also I feel like there should be a priority to try to give Black people back their history. And so this man, John Marshall, isn't the only person who has access to letters, documents, you know, other information related to people that were enslaved under their family. And they should share and try as much as possible to get that information back into the hands of people who may want to know that information. And then, you know, such practical things like, you know, I feel like part of reparations should be no Black person should ever have to pay for an Ancestry.com membership. You know, like we shouldn't charge us to try to piece back our history. Like that's something that should be provided to us for free and encouraged.
I support that idea for sure. That's a super smart idea.
Hold your head up high. It helps. No one can say, you know, go back to where you came from. Well, you know, if I'm not mistaken, I've been here pretty much as long or longer than you, you know? And so this is my country and I'm proud of that for better or for worse. And just because I want to make some changes, you know, just because you want to rehab your kitchen doesn't mean you just leave the house. You know, you rehab the kitchen, it looks better. And now you don't have that ugly tile anymore, you know? And so let's get rid of the ugly tile in America and put some nice new tile in there. Subway tile, so I still like vintage, but new subway tile. And let's, as you can see behind me, you know, we love vintage over here.
Mm-hmm. I see that for sure.
That's been the whole big process. So it's a large, rambling, confusing, joyful process.
So Lucy has a point here about, do you think that folks withhold the information if reparations ever happen? Like, are people going to be less forthright with their knowledge?
That's a great point, because I was just thinking, you know, as Black people have been prone to say in recent years, I got receipts, you know? Uh-huh. And so I have the receipts, you know I can prove that this and this happened and that I should be in that line to get reparations. And so I feel like maybe some people might feel that way, but I'm not trying to get money specifically from John Marshall or any of his relatives. I'm trying to get money from the federal government. And right. And I feel like I would hope that people would understand that they're not going to be personally sued. And I don't advocate that because I would hate to be personally sued for something that one of my ancestors did. Right. But at the same time, this country as a whole has built tremendous wealth. The federal government has built tremendous wealth on the backs of that. And the federal government should be the ones to pay for that.
They should make amends. Yeah. No question. Sam, we ran out of time, buddy. I know what happened. We accidentally talked the whole way through, like, and it was good and people were happy. And now I have to do this thing.
Oh, and here's our person of the day. Kaboom!
So lots of people could have got this. I'm giving it to Robert Collins. He was right up in this the whole time. So he says, you are unique, and isn't that the gift? We agree. But boy, there's a lot. So I feel like there's a million billion things. Out of all the different things that I shared, where do you think people want to pick up the second part of the Sam Lewis story? Should they come be your friend on Facebook or something, or where should they go?
I'd say go to that Google Sites, you know, and I highly encourage people, if they want to get a website, you know, that's a good place to get a free one. But yeah, go there, because there's a lot of examples of my work there. And I'm going to be fleshing out that page more as I go through this process of creating this family history piece, which I'm tentatively titling Everybody Knew Their Place.
Oh, I like it. Everybody Knew Their Place. This is big. So you're getting a lot of thank yous from Valerie and from Chloe over in Scotland, by the way. Oh, Scotland. So she might have loved your...
I'm part Scottish. I'm 5% Scottish, you know.
Good to know. So then we have a question that we've asked every guest. Thanks, Carl, and thanks, Kat. Thanks for sharing everything you did. This is amazing, says Lucy. We have a thing we do at every episode of the show, which is we ask every single guest that's ever been here, what goes in your backpack? People like Sister Ann Flanagan, people like Saida Trujillo, who is from Clowns Without Borders, Mexican horror comedy actor Horacio Garcia Rojas, what goes in your backpack? It could be something physical. It could be something metaphorical. It could be a sip of soup. It could be a determination. What kind of a thing do you need to put in your backpack, Sam Lewis?
So I thought about this beforehand, and I would say it's physical and it's metaphorical at the same time. And so two things that always go in my backpack physically are a gear bag, because to get through this life, you need tools, you need connections, you need resources. And so I have this huge bag of a neoprene bag filled with these gadgets and tools and connections and cables. So that's one thing, like, have physically that, but also, you know your resources and have resources in your backpack. Hey, Libras. And then also in my backpack physically is a toiletry bag. And that might be a little metrosexual for people, but I feel like you are somewhere and you need a nail file, or you need some toothpaste or a toothbrush or some deodorant or some scent to put on, some lotion. Black people, I know you hear me. Some lotion, like have your toiletry bag. And I feel like grooming and taking self-care is definitely something I would put in my backpack for sure.
So a gear bag and a toiletry bag. I think this works. I think you're ready to go, Sam Lewis.
You're ready to go anywhere.
So I was thinking about some of your taste in music, and my grandmother was a big Judas Priest fan. And nobody ever believed that ever, because she also liked, you know, Barry Manilow, and she liked the Village People. But she loved Judas Priest. She thought the song Breaking the Law was one of the coolest songs that ever was made. Except she used to get some of the lyrics wrong. So, for example...